Okay, we're now recording.
All right. Yep, participants are starting to flow in now.
They are.
We'll give it another minute and then we'll, sure, we'll get into the Q&A. Good. Oh, we have questions already coming from the audience.
Oh, good.
Well, we're probably good to start now as a prequel to the regular one, because we have a ton of questions already before the class has even begun. So if you're ready for questions, Hugh, I'm ready to pose them.
All right.
So the questions I'm going to do, the first four questions came from last week. The first one was from Don Hank, and he said, could you expand that the can't reach full intimacy in this dimension without marriage in the benefit side even a bit more, as you touched on in your talk? And I think he's talking about when you were discussing what it's going to be like in heaven. You described that intimacy in marriage is about as close as you're going to get here on earth, and it's going to be even more so in heaven. But I think his point is, he seems like he's saying you can't reach full intimacy in this dimension without marriage. So was that your point?
No, that's not my point at all. I mean, you don't have to be married to experience intimacy and relationships that God intends. It's just that because we're constrained to a single time dimension that can't be stopped or reversed, to really have a significant, intimate relationship with someone, you have to shut everybody else out. And so because we're constrained to one time dimension, we have to focus on one person at a time. We can focus on a bunch of people, but you're not really having a very intimate relationship if you're trying to spread it out over, say, dozens of people. And that's the principle of marriage. It's where man commits to say yes to one woman and no to all other women. And likewise, the woman commits to say yes to one man and no to all other men. And just the recognition that because of the constraints, we're in the dimensional constraints, that's the way it's got to be. And we're actually going to talk about that today in the class. The advantages of being in a single time dimension in this creation, and why we're going to be able to enjoy more time dimensions in the new creation. So time now must be linear in order to deal with the problem of evil and suffering. But in the new creation, that won't be an issue, which means God's going to release us to be able to have the equivalent of an undivided private conversation, one-on-one, with billions of other individuals simultaneously. Now, how that works, what kind of brain we're going to need to make that work, I don't know. But we do get a new body.
Okay, well, thank you. Next one comes from Chris Thompson in Anchorage, Alaska. Numerous references in scripture indicate where miracles would have God altering or suspending of the laws of physics. Would you comment about this, please?
Yes. And this is interesting, because when I engage a lot of atheist scientists, they think we Christians believe that God's got only one miraculous tool in his tool chest, and that is to perform a miracle from beyond the laws of physics and space-time dimensions. He certainly can do that. In fact, we got proof that he can do that in the very beginning of the universe. The space-time theorems tell us there must be a causal agent beyond space-time, matter, and energy. But as you read the New and Old Testament, far more frequently, God performs a miracle within the laws of physics and within the space-time dimensions. And these would be miracles that would be akin to, for example, us human beings mining iron, copper, and aluminum ore out of the ground and transforming it into a sophisticated aircraft. And, you know, God likewise works within the natural resources of the realm and produces something that would never happen by natural process alone. I mean, you're not going to get a fighter jet craft that's going to be the result of a tornado going through an iron and aluminum mine. That's not going to happen. And so likewise, but that's probably about 95 to 98% of the miracles we see in the Bible are in that category. But we see in the book of Colossians, God also performs miracles in sustaining the laws of physics and in sustaining the realm of nature. Basically makes the point if God were to withdraw his miraculous sustaining hand from the realm of nature, every one of us would breathe their last breath, every atom would disintegrate, every particle would disappear, and there'd be nothing.
Okay. Doug McComb from Monrovia, California says, Thayer's dictionary defines God's grace also as God's influence upon our heart. God's grace was and is never intended to be licensed for sin. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. And also would add that the traditional definition, and I think what he's pointing out is that this grace that we see mentioned in the New Testament, there's a lot of meaning in that that we easily overlook. And so Thayer's is actually bringing out those that are often overlooked. But typically, it's God giving us favors and privileges that we don't deserve. I mean, we deserve to be rejected. Instead, he comes in and provides us with undeserved grace. And he gives that to both unbelievers and believers. But believers receive more grace from God than unbelievers do.
Okay. Thank you. Craig McMahon asks, what are the forces pushing for shorter classes? This is not the first instance where churches I've attended have pushed for short 6 to 8 week classes. It's not as though most Sunday school classes are built so that if one misses a week or two, you can't understand the subsequent classes. It seems as though one cannot get much depth from short classes.
Well, notice that the classes that we're having here are a little long, and I'm taking short material I've developed and expanding it because I figure, hey, this is an opportunity to do this for the class structured this way. But once this pandemic subsides, the church that I'm part of the pastoral staff of a church, they really want us to do short subjects. So we're going to segue into classes that'll be structured between 2 and 8 weeks. And it doesn't mean we can't take on longer material. It's just that we're going to break it up into smaller chunks. And the whole idea is that they want us to video record this and actually make it available online. You say, why don't we do that now? You really don't get quality video recording through Zoom. So that may come with better software. And also, it's a different dynamic when you're in front of a live audience. And so the church really would prefer that we wait until we have a live audience where we got good cameras and could get quality recording. And that way it's up on the internet. And if people miss a class, they can just go to the internet and pick up the class they missed. The whole idea is we want to be able to offer a high quality video recording when we do that. So that's why I've waited. And just in case people are wondering, the series that the church is asking me to launch once we're able to meet in person again is basically to go through those first 11 chapters of Genesis, break it up into chunks, but each chunk would be no more than 8 weeks long. And also, we want to give opportunities to members of the Reasons to Believe scholar community to come in and do their little short sessions. We got some amazing scholars. You're one of them, Mark. So we look forward to you developing a series that you can offer here in the class. And that's going to help me because once the pandemic is over, I'm going to be traveling again. And so being able to have some of the people from a scholar community jump in and do anywhere from a 2 to 8 week series, that would be great.
Okay. Stephen Posta from Spring, Texas So since we've seen in our telescope, what we've seen in our telescope shows the past, and the images that we see are limited to travel at the speed of light, is the following scenario possible? Using the presumption that the universe could end via the Big Rip, as you've described it in the past, could the initial folding over of the space-time dimensions already have made their initial contact at the far end of the observable universe and just haven't proceeded far enough in our direction to be observed in our telescopes? In other words, could the end of the universe already be underway and we just don't know it yet?
Well, it depends on how it ends. I think he's referring to what's called the ekpyrotic Big Bang creation model, where you get the top surface of the 10-dimensional sheet touching the bottom surface. If that were to happen, the entire surface disappears relatively quickly. So, and keep in mind, the surface of the universe is not subject to the velocity of light. So that can expand or contract much more rapidly than the velocity of light. And so most of these ekpyrotic models, you get the space-time fabric of the universe disappearing into a singularity relatively quickly. So we're not waiting millions of years for that to happen, given that it's already started. If it's already started, you're probably looking at a few seconds before everything disappears.
Oh, that's pretty quick.
That's pretty quick, yeah.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Doug from Monrovia again. Good morning, folks. I have a couple of questions. What are Hawking points, in quotes? Are they observable in the cosmic background, cosmic microwave background sky, as Roger Penrose has claimed in his writings of late? And are these Hawking points evidence of any significance of a previous universe existing before ours?
Well, I'm getting a ton of questions on that subject on my Facebook and Twitter pages. And that's because what Penrose has been proposing is getting a lot more internet exposure than it has even a week ago. And just to be fair to Roger Penrose, he's one of the world's leading theoretical physicists. His fame goes back to being partnering with Stephen Hawking to bring out the first of the space-time theorems. What I like about Penrose is that, as a theoretical physicist, he will often produce stuff that's highly speculative, but he'll tell you that it is. And he's quite honest in saying, look, what I'm proposing here is highly speculative, but boy, is the math ever fun. And, there's actually a way to put this to the test. And so what he's proposing is this idea that there's a past universe that contracts down to a singularity and transitions to our present expanding universe. Now, to show you the speculation, all this, long before he developed this, he was in a course with Stephen Hawking, interesting course. It was on God and time, eternity and the universe. And basically it got Hawking and Penrose each taking a class, but they kind of did it as a friendly debate over the course of a whole semester. But in that course, he was asked this question: is it possible for a previous contracting universe to transition to a future expanding universe, namely ours? And he made the point that it's conceivable that could happen, but the probability of joining the geometry of a past contracting universe with a present expanding universe is essentially zero. It's basically the same problem you run into with wormholes. Wormholes are mathematically possible, but physically impossible. If you're not familiar with that term, a wormhole is where you got two black holes that happen to come close enough together that the singularity of one black hole perfectly touches the singularity of the second black hole, which would actually permit travel from one space-time realm through the black hole through that point where the two singularities perfectly touch and come out into a different space-time realm. And of course, that's been exploited mightily in a lot of science fiction movies and novels. Mathematically, it's conceivable. Physically, the probability that you would get those two singularities perfectly touching, that probability is zero. The probability that it would remain stable enough that you could go through would be zero. And you wouldn't want to go through it anyway, because as you go through into the event horizon of a black hole, Your body will be stretched out about 3 miles long into a string of fundamental particles. And as you get sucked in towards the singularity, the particles get destroyed. So you're not going to go through a wormhole. And likewise, it's mathematically conceivable that you could have a past shrinking or contracting universe join up with a future expanding universe. But the physical probability of that happening is zero. What was interesting about what Penrose is saying says, if that did happen, we would expect to see some anomalies in the cosmic radiation background maps. And we do see some anomalies, particularly in the Planck map of the cosmic microwave background radiation. And he says, you know, maybe we could put this to the test. Well, I can tell you, having looked at those cosmic microwave background maps, they do not show the signature of these Hawking points. But Penrose's point is, with better maps, we could put this to the test and see. But again, he's very careful in saying what I'm proposing is highly speculative. And given the physical probabilities, it's probably, I mean, but that was the whole idea. It says if this really did happen, there's actually a way to observationally put this to the test. Bottom line is, we don't have maps good enough to make that kind of test. The best map we have is a Planck, and it shows no evidence of those Hawking points.
Thank you, Hugh. I think we're now at the time when you would begin your webinar.
Okay, I'll get that started. And this is being recorded. So, and by the way, we record all the episodes of the Paradoxes class. So if you miss any of them, you can download them for free at paradoxes.org. So with that, let me share a screen so you can see my visuals. Okay, I'm going to begin with this slide because we're going to do what we've been doing the last several weeks. We're in the webinar mode right now, which is very secure. But when we end the webinar, and we'll be ending it at about noon, I'm going to invite all of you to come into a web meeting. And in the Zoom meeting, we're all going to be able to turn our cameras on, our microphones on, and engage one another. I'll have the capability of breaking us up into small discussion groups, and so we can discuss some of the points that we've been talking about in the class. This is the address you're going to need, the URL. It's the same one we've been using for the past 5 weeks. So if you've already got that noted down, it's the same. And as soon as we're done with the webinar, you will have to shut down the webinar. A number of you have been running into problems when you don't do that and you try to get in the meeting, it asks you for a password. I've got it set up. You don't need a password. All you need is this URL. But do leave the webinar, exit out, and go back in with your browser with this URL, and that'll automatically put you into the meeting. And once we're in the meeting, I'm going to have to take all of you out of the waiting room and put you into the meeting. So give me a few minutes to do that. And then we'll be able to break up into groups. What we did last week as an experiment, we had some time in our small groups, then we came back together and shared. And that was really a wonderful time. So I think we're going to do that again. But this is what you're going to need. And I'll put this slide up again, what I'm done with the teaching time. And before we begin, I'm all excited because literally about an hour ago, I finished the first draft of my next book. My deadline was to get it done by December 1st. I actually got it done ahead of time. And actually what I'm going to do is actually go through and do a self-edit of that book before I turn it over to our editors. But it was exciting for me because I made a lot of discoveries in going through the scientific literature. It's a book where we talk about the internal design features of our super galaxy cluster, our galaxy cluster, our local group of galaxies, our galaxy. And we go all the way down to the local neighborhood of our sun, our star, our solar system, then looking at all the interior layers of our Earth. Its inner core, its outer core, its mantle, its asthenosphere, and its crust. And yes, I just finished the last chapter of the book literally an hour ago. So that's fun. But What was really thrilling, I had a time to meet with Fazal Rana, our staff biochemist, and a couple of weeks ago, he handed in the draft of his book. He's writing a book on the biochemical anthropic principle. Just like there's an anthropic principle in astronomy, he says there's one in biochemistry. We're both convinced there's one in every single discipline of science. It was thrilling for me to see he had the same experience I did. Both of us read over 1,000 scientific research papers and begin to see links, linking research in one paper with researchers in other papers. And as we made those links, I just made some amazing discoveries that we're thrilled to talk to you about in the book, but just seeing how it impacted him and impacted him the same way it impacted me. It's just such a thrill to see as you research these papers and make these links, do the integration. It really does demonstrate the biblical principle that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we see for the supernatural handiwork of God. So I'm a little bit excited and thrilled. That's the reason why. And likewise, when you engage Fuzz, I think you're going to see the same exuberance coming out of him. But what we're going to be talking about today is, why would God subject us and the universe to so much decay? And a few of us here are astronomers, and we can all tell you that when we look at the universe, we're stunned by just how much decay there is in the universe. I mean, there's a huge amount of decay. And this is actually something you see in Romans chapter 8. It tells us in verse 21 and 22 that the entire creation has been groaning under its bondage to decay. Some translations will say frustration, but it's making the point that the whole of the universe is subject to this pervasive law of decay, what we physicists and astronomers refer to as the second law of thermodynamics, what a lot of lay people call Murphy's Law. No matter what you do, everything's going to decay. And I've run into audiences where they actually say, we're not sure that's really true. I say, well, if you're not, just look at one another and recognize we're all experiencing this decay. Your homes, your offices, everything you look at is undergoing this extreme level of decay. And a relatively new discovery made by some Australian astronomers, they've actually measured where is all the entropy in the universe. And what was quite amazing is that almost all of the entropy resides in black holes. Supermassive black holes have got more than 99.9% of all the entropy of the universe, and stellar mass black holes have got almost all the rest, and the rest of the universe actually has very little. And if it wasn't that way, there'd be no possibility of life in the universe. And so not only is it crucial, as we're going to find out, that the rate of decay, which is a measure of entropy, that the rate of decay must be fine-tuned to make our physical existence possible. Where that entropy is in the universe also is crucial in order for life to be possible. But here we have in Romans 8, no matter where you go in the universe, where you go in God's physical creation, all of it is undergoing ongoing decay. Now, why is this necessary? We could literally spend weeks discussing all the reasons why we have to have this high rate of decay in the universe. I'm just going to give you a couple of physical reasons, and then I'll give you four spiritual reasons why we have to have this high rate of decay. But here are a couple of physical reasons why we need this high rate of decay. If it wasn't for the fact that the universe and everything in it is decaying at a very rapid rate, you wouldn't have stars and planets. So the formation of stars and planets in the universe requires a very high level of entropy, and you need stars and planets for physical life to be possible. And likewise, we need a high rate of decay for plants to be able to produce food via photosynthesis, and for we animals to actually feed on those plants and digest that food. If we didn't have a high rate of decay, you literally would not be able to metabolize plant tissues and transform that into useful work. And so it's important, for example, that our human bodies have a relatively low rate of efficiency. I mean, if you've got a really good gasoline engine in your car, it might be able to convert energy into work with about 35 to 40% efficiency. Your human body, it's less than a percent efficiency. It's about 0.1% efficiency. You say, couldn't God make it higher so it'd make life a lot easier for us? If he did, you simply wouldn't be able to digest food at all in order to be able to perform work. For one thing, you need the release of heat to be low enough that it doesn't do damage. For example, the operation of your brain requires a highly fine-tuned temperature. So these are a couple of reasons. And again, we could spend weeks giving you all kinds of reasons why it's got to be this way. But I want to segue to giving some spiritual reasons. And one thing we notice is the rate of decay in the physical realm is not so high as to discourage us from productive work. I mean, as it is, any work we perform, anything we create, immediately after we create it, begins to undergo decay. But given the fact that we live 80, 90 years, what we notice is that the rate of decay is not so high that we just give up and say, you know what, I'm not going to build a cottage. I'm not going to build some furniture. You know, it's possible to take some wood from trees, transform it into furniture. That's going to last your entire lifetime. It's not going to last multiple lifetimes, but it will last your lifetime. And a lot of things that we create don't last that long. They last only a month or two, but it's like, hey, I can enjoy it for at least a month before it completely decays away. And so the decay rate is not so high where you say everything I create, it gets dissipated by entropy within a few hours, so why bother? Just totally give up. No, it's low enough that we're not discouraged and we actually get joy from what we create. Matter of fact, you can look at your life here on earth as a gift of labor. God gives us a certain amount of time in which to be able to work. And we're told in Ecclesiastes, we're to enjoy the product of our work. And so work is intended to be enjoyable because of what we're able to produce from our work. And that joy is not robbed by such an extremely high rate of decay. But the other thing we notice is the decay rate is not so low as to let sin go unrestrained. People say, well, wouldn't it be better if we didn't have such a high rate of decay? Well, without that, then we would see sin and evil begin to rise out of control. And this is a message that's developed extensively in the Bible, but it's literally tied in to the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions that we see. So what we notice is that the rate of decay is at the precise level that it optimally restrains evil. So if we had less decay or more decay, we wouldn't have the restraint of evil that we observe in this universe. And we'll get into this in some detail. But something that's overlooked, and this is what we're going to be getting into and being to go through all the New Testament passages about suffering, is that the rate of decay is optimized in preparing us for our new roles and careers in the new creation. We all have a career in this creation. The career we're going to have in the new creation is going to be completely different. I'm not going to be studying stars and galaxies in new creation because those stars and galaxies won't even be there. I'm going to have a completely different role. And I think many of us that are part of this class have had the experience of transitioning from one career to another career. And that's good in the sense that's what we're going to be doing as we move from this creation to the new creation. But this creation is structured in such a way, the law of decay is structured in such a way as to optimally prepare us for our new careers and the new creation. And what makes this challenging for all of us, we don't really have a clear view of what the new creation will be like. We're not told what our careers are going to be like in the new creation, except in very broad general terms. We discussed that. We went through the purposes of the new creation last week. So you can get that recording if you missed that. that we do have some hint, but not explicitly, but we just need to recognize, okay, just like often we trust our professors at the university to put us through the training that they know is crucial to prepare us for our future careers. We may not see how it all fits in, but we basically trust them, saying, okay, this is very difficult, but we know it's necessary. And so in some element, we're expected to trust God in the sense he really has designed this rate of decay in the way that's going to ultimately prepare us for an incredible life and career in the new creation. Now, having said all that, take you back to Genesis chapter 3. Here we got Adam and Eve in the garden, and this is before they experienced any rebellion against God, before they had any concept of sin and evil. And God invites Satan to come into the garden to put them to the test, and they fail the test. And once they begin to experience sin and evil, and you know, God put these two trees in the garden, the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And really what God was communicated to Adam and Eve, look, you can either come to me and I'll instruct you about sin and evil, or you can use your free will to experience it directly. And they chose to experience it directly. And you know, Satan basically was saying, God's robbing you. He's not going to let you experience this. And God's intent is all along, look, I'm going to teach you about it. You don't have to experience it. And all of us have been parents, have had this experience with our children, where we basically tell them, look, we're going to teach you these things so that you don't have to suffer the consequences. But all of us have had the experience of watching our children basically ignoring our instruction and going ahead and experience it and see what it's like. And then we who are parents have to watch them suffer the consequences. Well, likewise, consequences happened to Adam and Eve when they rebelled against their creator. And God had literally set up the universe in advance. He set up the thermodynamics in advance. He set up all the laws of physics in advance and the space-time dimensions. So at the moment that Adam and Eve chose to experience sin rather than simply to be taught about it, he said, well, from now on, in proportion to the sin that you commit, you'll be experiencing more pain, more work, and more wasted time. Why? To undo the damage caused by your sin and evil. When any of us commits sin, when any of us expresses evil, there will be damage. There will be collateral damage. And someone's got to clean it up. And when they do, they experience more work than is necessary, more pain than is necessary, and more time to undo the damage than would be necessary if the act of sin had not happened. And when you read Genesis chapter 3, it basically talks about how God says to the man, because of what you've done, you're going to have to work harder. And he says to the woman, because of what you've done, you're going to experience more pain. And it's a mistake, at least in my opinion, to think that that's gender specific. I don't think it's gender specific at all. This is something that happens to both male and female, that in proportion to their sin, they'll be experiencing more pain and more work. And you know, all you women out there recognize it's not just us men that have to work harder when sin happens. The women do as well. And likewise, when it talks, when God says to Eve, you're going to be experiencing more pain in childbirth, it's not just the women that experience that pain, the men do as well. It's something that my wife shared with me. I mean, any of you who have met my wife, Kathy, she's not a big woman at all. She's like 5'4.5" and, you know, 110, 115 pounds, quite slim. And, you know, I come from a family where the men are big. I'm the smallest man in my family. All the other men in our family are over 6 feet. In fact, I've got two close relatives that are 6'7". And so Kathy had two really big babies. Both of them were 23.5 inches long and more than 9 pounds. She had a lot of physical pain in childbirth. And I had to watch that. So it was painful for me to watch her go through that pain. Much more painful of her, of course. But years later, she shared with me, that was nothing compared to the pain that both of us had to experience watching our sins, watching our sons commit sins they didn't have to commit and shouldn't have committed and suffering the consequences. And so the pain of childbirth lasts decades after the birth of our children. And so that's something that men experience as well as women. And of course, we all experience more wasted time. And some people make the mistake. I've run into this in a number of my debates with younger creationists who actually interpret this text. This is the first time pain was experienced by humans. It's the first time work was experienced by humans. And that is simply an incorrect interpretation. After all you need to do is look at Genesis chapter 2. And God has Adam working the garden before he creates Eve. He has him working the garden before he sins. And so work was happening. And you would need pain. It's important, for example, when Adam is walking around the garden in bare feet, that if he steps on a rock, he feels some pain and basically learns to avoid that. But the whole point here, that now that they are sinners, they're going to experience more pain than they would have if they hadn't sinned at all. And likewise, they're going to have to do more work, and they're going to have to waste more time. Now, I remember sharing this with both of my sons, Joel and David, when they were growing up, because I let them say, hey, you can borrow my tools out of my workbench in the garage. And all of my tools had a special place where they hang. I said, you can borrow them, but please put them back after you're done, and show them all exactly where they are. And but boys being boys, they took my tools. They're working on one of their projects in the backyard, and they forgot to bring the tools back into the garage and hang them on the hooks that I had there. And we have an automatic sprinkler system. You pretty well have to have that here in Southern California if you want anything to grow. And so a couple of weeks later, I was going through a backyard, and I found three highly rusted tools. And so I gathered those tools up, showed them to both of my sons, and said, you know, this is a consequence of you not putting the tools back where they belong. And look at all this orange rust on them. And so I gave them each one of those little steel wool pads. And I said, I want you to work on these tools until all the orange stuff is completely gone. And I'm going to decide whether it's all gone, not you. And they got to experience a lot of extra work, a lot of extra pain, and a lot of wasted time. And I explained to them how the laws of physics are set up to guarantee that this would happen, just to undo the consequences. But what they told me when they were 20s is that the worst thing about, and the most painful part of the discipline I took them through as they were growing up, were my lectures on the laws of physics. So we had a good laugh about that. But it is true. So I shared with them, look, if I don't discipline you, the laws of physics will. And the laws of physics are going to guarantee that indeed there will be more pain and more work and more wasted time. And you can save a lot of extra work, pain, and wasted time if you simply listen to the instruction of people that God has put in authority over you. It will save you from committing many sins that will lead to these kinds of consequences. And that's true for all of us, but also explains why in the Bible you see that God has established authority within our human community. And so we have parents that are given authority over their children. We have the police and the government that's given authority over the citizens. And then nations have armies that they can use to exercise authority over rogue nations. And so, and then we've got teachers and classrooms who have authority over their students. And what these authority figures are commanded to do by God is to ensure in part that those under their authority that commit the sins are the ones that experience more pain, more work, and more wasted time. And that's something all of us have been parents, I think, need to pay attention to. It's so much faster, for example, for me to undo the damage caused by my sons. I can do it faster than they can do it, and trying to get them to do it and motivate them to do it and supervise them to do it, that's more painful often than me just cleaning it up all by myself. But that's not what's best for my sons. It's best that I go to them and make sure they're the ones that experience the extra pain, the extra work, and the wasted time. And yes, if it caused me pain and work and wasted time to ensure that they're the ones that experience it, that's actually long-term going to work out to my benefit, because it's going to encourage them to commit less sin than otherwise. You know, and Mark Perez here, he was with the LAPD. He can tell you our justice system is set up this way. Our prison system is set up this way. The whole idea is that when an individual commits a major crime, the punishment for that crime is to be meted out in such a way that the criminal is the one that experiences extra pain, extra work, and wasted time. The restitution system is basically set up to make that happen. And of course, none of us is able to do it perfectly, but the whole idea is to ensure that the laws of physics do what God has intended them to do. Now, it's not just the laws of physics. And by the way, we're not just talking thermodynamics. Yes, the Bible kind of makes the point that the whole universe is subject to decay. This pervasive law of decay is designed in such a way that the more we sin, the more damage results as a result of the law of decay. We can actually speed up the damage, the decay rate. That's what sin does. It actually makes things decay faster than they otherwise would. But it's also true that the law of gravity, the laws of electromagnetism, the strong and weak nuclear force, they're all connected in such a way and all optimally designed to guarantee that the more we humans sin, the more pain we experience, the more work we have to do, the more time that we waste. I've written about this extensively in my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. And incidentally, anyone can get a free chapter of that book by going to reasons.org/Ross, basically making the point that when you look at the law of gravity, the law of laws of thermodynamics, electromagnetism, and the nuclear force laws, each one of those is optimally designed to ensure that the more evil that's committed by us human beings, the more pain we experience, the more work we do, the more time we waste, but then it does it in such a way that we do not give up on performing useful work and creating things. And it is such, so that's when people say, well, you know, couldn't God made life a lot more pleasant for us if we didn't have these laws that generate all this decay? We need to realize that's there to ensure that we do experience these consequences. And hence, each one of us, simply because of the laws of physics, are motivated to avoid sin and pursue virtue. Because who likes extra pain, extra work, and wasted time? We're biologically designed in such a way that we despise having to go through a whole lot more pain and work and wasted time than is necessary. And so this powerfully motivates us to avoid evil, if for no other reason, to avoid suffering these consequences. But in the process, we discover we can't completely avoid it. Yes, we're motivated to avoid sin, and a lot of us are able to put that sin behind us, but we still sin. Now, what's interesting is yesterday I was involved in a podcast where I actually was engaging people who claimed that they were totally free of sin. And so I just started asking questions, and it's like, yeah, they thought they had overcome sin in their life, and to some degree they had, but the truth is none of us can live up to the moral law that's written on our hearts. Just like God has written eternity in the heart of every human being, he's written his moral law as standard of behavior. And the very fact that our conscience reacts when we violate that, as Jesus said, look, if you're without sin, you're actually claiming you never have an evil thought in your mind. You never have any kind of temptation or lust that overtakes you. And so therefore, it's not just the actions that we do that cause more pain, more work, and wasted time. It's our words. Our words can do a lot of damage. Our thoughts can do a lot of damage. And so we're responsible to control our actions, our words, and our thoughts. And with that standard in place, we realize we simply are not able to avoid the sin in our life. We can minimize it, but we can't avoid it totally. And our conscience tells us, this is a standard God wants us to live up to. This is a standard that he demands. And so these laws of physics, he basically tell us, we can't live up to the moral standards that are written upon our heart. But as we look at the universe and realize how wonderfully designed the universe, the earth and earth's life is, to make our existence possible, to make our civilization possible. We look at the extravagance of what God has provided for our well-being. What this tells us is that the God behind the universe is a very loving God, cares for us a great deal, cares for us to such a great deal that he would not leave us in a hopeless situation. Because of his great love revealed in creation, we know that he is prepared to intervene to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. So these laws of physics, this law of decay, communicates to us that there is a redeemer out there, someone prepared to pay the price for what we're not to pay on our own, someone to deliver us from the sin that we can't deliver ourselves from. And so these laws of physics basically motivate us to go to the Creator, to go to the Creator Redeemer, and take advantage of the offer that he has made through his great love to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And it's not just the laws of physics, it's the space-time dimensions. In the Q&A we had before we got started today, we talked about how in this universe, we're constrained to a single dimension of time that can't be reversed, that can't be stopped. Yes, if you were to travel a little bit faster, you can slow down the rate of the passage of time. So we can slow or speed up the passage of time by how fast we move relative to other bodies. But we can't reverse it, we can't stop it, and we're constrained to a single dimension. And because of the fact that we're constrained to a single time dimension, it limits our human contacts. And so because I'm constrained to a single dimension of time, I can't get to all the people I want to get to. And, you know, there's a lot of Christians I've met all over the world in my years of travel and ministry, and I think about them a lot and how much I'd like to be able to spend some quality time with them, but realize it's just not possible. There's not, because I'm constrained to a single dimension of time, there's no way I can have that fellowship with them that I really crave. But it also benefits humanity another way, that people who have evil intent in their heart, because they're constrained to a single dimension of time, they're not going to be able to get to all the people they want to get to do them harm. And we see that particularly with the despots throughout world history. There's been many world leaders who've come up and basically had a great hatred for a particular people group and tried to wipe them out. We got recent examples, for example, in Mao Zedong, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Pol Pot. These are individuals in just the past century who literally each of them killed millions, tens of millions of human beings, and actually did so to such a great degree, it actually harmed their own best interests. You know, this is what tells us that this evil has a supernatural source, because here we got these human beings committing so much evil to such a great degree, as we mentioned earlier in this series, it actually does them physical harm. They harm themselves through the evil they've committed. But because they're limited in time, they're not able to do all the harm they want to all of their fellow human beings. So in that sense, it's essential that we be constrained to a single dimension of time, because if we weren't, people like Adolf Hitler would have killed a whole lot more people than he was able to kill. And yes, he's famous for wiping out 6.5 million Jews, but in the last year of his life, he actually concocted a plan to wipe out the German nation because they let him down in bringing about his defeat. And so in the last year of his life, he was killing Germans left and right. And this also indicates that our short lifespans help us. Adolf Hitler only lived to be 56. And, you know, he did commit suicide, but he was on his deathbed anyway. He was dying. And that short lifespan actually limited the degree of harm that he was able to commit. And just his knowledge that he was terminal basically caused him to make decisions that actually saved millions of lives. So our short lifespans are helpful. And we get a lesson about that in the early chapters of Genesis, when God actually allowed human beings to have the capability of living not just 70 to 90 years, but living 700 to 900 years. And what we learn in those early chapters of Genesis, those long lifespans that human beings had the potential to live really worked for those who are evil more so than those who are righteous. When the simple point is that if you've got a serial killer on your hand that is able to exercise the murdering of people over hundreds of years, they're going to kill a lot of people. And moreover, who are they going to target? They're not going to target other serial killers. They're going to be targeting the righteous. And so we see in the chapters before Noah is that the human population was being decimated, and the ones that are being killed off were the righteous to such a degree. By the time we come to Noah, there's only one righteous family left amongst all of humanity. And, you know, for those of you who think it'd be great to live that number of years again, I mean, we all would like to be able to live a little bit longer here on Earth. What I think is interesting is that today, we human beings are probably experiencing the longest average lifespan that has ever happened since the days of Adam and Eve. Yes, before Noah, you had the potential to live 800 or 900 years, but we see in those early chapters, most human beings did not die natural deaths. They had their lives being terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. And I deal with this in Navigating Genesis, actually show you some tables there demonstrating that the death rate by murder had to be above 95%. More than 95% of humans at that time had their lives terminated by being murdered by their fellow man. So when you look at Genesis 5 and 11, you see those genealogies there of the patriarchs who lived 800, 900, 969 years. We may be looking at an abbreviated list of those patriarchs that managed to avoid being murdered by their fellow man, whereas the vast majority were having their lives terminated when they were in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s. And to explain how limited the population was at that time, given the reproductive rate, you had to have a murder rate above 95%. And so God blessed us after the flood and said, I'm going to shorten the lifespan. And shortening that lifespan limited the spread of evil enough that the righteous were not being killed off. And it's a principle you see in the book of Isaiah that, you know, it's not to the advantage of the evil people that keep committing evil. When someone is totally out of control with their evil, it's actually to their advantage that God terminates their life early in order that they not have to experience greater torment in the lake of fire than otherwise would be the case. And lastly here, space separates us. You know, we live in a universe of three large dimensions of space, and those dimensions of space actually spread us apart from one another to a sufficient degree that, say, if I turn out that I'm really angry at somebody that I know in South Africa and I really want to do them some physical harm, chances are I'm not going to be able to express it. They're just too far away. I'm not going to be able to get to them. That even applies locally. I mean, if you're really angry at a relative, for example, that lives 25 miles away, that 25 miles may be enough to prevent you from committing the evil that's on your heart towards that person. And that benefits all of us. Well, I've seen I've gone quite a bit over time, so I'm going to stop here. And this is the URL that you're going to need. And I'll pop this up again after a Q&A time. But this is the URL that we're going to use at 12 noon Pacific time to segue from the webinar into a meeting. And so again, I'll bring that up at the end. And with that, let me stop the share feature and we'll go into the Q&A until about 12 noon.
Hugh, I will bring in Yuvan at noon. Would that be a good time? He's agreed to be interviewed.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, you can bring him in right now if you want, but we can. Yeah, why don't you bring him in now? Because at noon, I want to be able to get us into meetings. Is that possible?
Yes, hang on just a second.
Sure.
Okay, Yuvan, you can turn on your microphone and your camera, and Hugh will interview you. I'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, Yuvan, this is a feature we're trying to build into the Paradoxes class. What we're realizing is this pandemic is lasting a little bit longer than all of us thought months ago. And one of the things we used to do when we were meeting in person is we would have people come up and just share their story of how they came to faith in Christ and how they developed in their Christian walk. Thank you for agreeing to actually share with us briefly about that. So why don't you begin by telling us how it is that you found Jesus Christ as your Creator, Lord, and Savior. And incidentally, Yuvan, could you first begin by telling people where you are and what your educational background is and a little bit about your persona. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Ross, and also thank you, Mark Perez, for this opportunity. So I was kind of a little nervous in the beginning, and then so I'll just go for it. I'm from Malaysia originally, and I've been living in the Netherlands for almost going to be 7 years. And I'm coming from a science background as well, but more towards biology and chemistry. So I did my bachelor's in both bachelor's and master's in Malaysia. So my bachelor's was in biotechnology and my master's was in forensic science. So there's not a linear academic trajectory, so different academic lines. And I came to the Netherlands to do a PhD. I finished the PhD in behavioral biology and also toxicology. So that was my academic...
What was your thesis title?
I have my thesis here, actually. So
let's show it to us.
So, this is my... But yeah, it's a bit flipped because of the camera. So the title is The Role of Zebrafish Larvae for Studying Anxiety-like Behavior. So I used a special model organism. It's called zebrafish larvae. Normally, we use mouse and other mammals, but the larvae have its potential advantages in using for this kind of study. So what irony is that this thesis touches on anxiety-like behaviors, and my PhD period was the most anxious period in my life and also most loneliest period of my life, actually. So I suffered a lot of personal problems because during my PhD, after just 6 months I started my PhD, my mother passed away. So I had to go back to Malaysia for the funeral and other stuff related. But that's when my journey started, actually. And I confessed that I want to be the follower of Jesus exactly on in the year of 2015. And it was during Easter celebration, actually. During that time, this transformation happened in my life. So in the beginning, I accepted Jesus as my Lord and Savior.
That was in 2015, you said?
2015, yes.
Yeah.
So, and then the questions on science-related questions came, actually. So that's when, you know, Dr. Ross's book, and then I was watching his close with Reasons to Believe ministry and job. That was my journey. Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. I didn't know you wrote a thesis on anxiety. And you know, all of us are going through anxiety with this pandemic. So that's also interesting that as you were doing your research on anxiety, that was actually having some personal benefit for you too. So that's incredible. And I, you know, thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah.
And you know, it's great that we actually are engaging people from around the world in this class. I like the fact that you're getting to meet one another. So all of you out there, this is Yuvan, this is his story. And yeah, we're gonna try to get others of you too to share just like he has shared. But yeah, you're now 5 years in the Lord. So were you raised in a Christian home?
No, I was not raised in a Christian home at all. So I was raised in a more like a Hinduism background. Mm-hmm. But I had, you know, I was also trying other religion like Buddhism. Mm-hmm. I was not really Islam. But in Malaysia, it's more like Islam is the main religion. So
right,
I know
right.
these principles and their teachings as well. So, but we do have some influence of Christianity, I say, because in Hinduism, it's more like pantheistic worldview. So they, some of the Hindus also consider Jesus as one of the deity, but not the God. So the,
right.
yeah, Hindus also believe that.
Okay, well, thank you. And Mark, we can segue to the Q&A time.
Hey, thank you very much, Yuvan. It was great seeing you.
Yeah.
Okay, the first question comes from Jay from Glendale, Arizona. And he says, as you're living in California, do you see the current standard of life deteriorating and the current political environment becoming hostile to your ministry?
Good question. And I'll have to be careful here because we have a policy at Reasons to Believe that we avoid discussing politics. So I'm not going to talk about the candidates or the election items that are coming up. But I'm going to try to put this in a biblical context, that all of us as believers are subject to the political authorities that are over us. We're to pray for them, whether they be good or bad. And by the way, there's never been a perfectly good politician. That's not going to happen. And yeah, all of us, when we're called to vote, often we think we're voting for the lesser of the two, three, or four evils. That's not new. That's the way it's always been. The New Testament tells us that's the way it is. And consequently, whatever we personally feel or think about the political leaders that are over us, we're to pray for them. And we're to pray for them specifically. So for example, living here in California, personally, I do see some things that I think need to be changed here in California. And so I pray for the political leaders here that they will recognize those needs for those change. Maybe they don't like the change, but they might see the need for that out of their own personal self-interest. So yeah, it's important that we pray for them. And I look at what's going on here in the West, and it's not just California, but Oregon, the state of Washington, we're dealing with a lot of wildfires, and we look at what's going on, realize, a lot of this is a result of poor forest management. And so this is an opportunity to say, okay, things have happened. We look at the pandemic. I mean, there's a lot on the internet about how different states of the 50 states of the US are not responding as they should towards the pandemic. And again, and I keep telling people, look, we're dealing with a virus. Viruses are highly unpredictable. And so let's give these political leaders a little bit of grace and realize too, they might be telling us, you all need to wear masks. You all need to stay 6 feet apart. But it doesn't work if we don't obey what they're recommending we do. And a lot of us are just so frustrated at the lack of social contact with one another. We literally say, you know what? I don't care. I got to go see my friend. I haven't really had contact with him. And so, again, make sure that we're not putting all the blame on our authority figures. Again, I was using an analogy in the class of parents and children. Children are skilled at putting it all on their parents. And, we can do that with the leaders that are over us and not really take the responsibility we need to take. To say, okay, what role have I had and making the state of California a worse state than otherwise has to be. And I'm not just picking in California, that could apply to any state. That's about as far as I'm going to push it, because otherwise I'm going to get into trouble with my board of directors here.
Thank you, Hugh. We got a question from Yuvin. It says, my question is, would Jesus have felt lonely when he incarnated as man on earth? Some say Jesus is God and could have not felt human feelings, but the New Testament scripture says foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. I feel somehow this verse shows Jesus' fully human nature of being lonely. What do you think?
Well, for certain that was going on when he was dying on the cross, because God the Father turned his back on God the Son. And so here was the creator of the universe, personally alone. The Holy Spirit and God the Father basically abandoned him. And so he felt very intense loneliness there. The humans around him. So yeah, he was fully man and fully God. And being fully man, he experienced all the emotions and losses that we experience. And as it tells us in the book of Isaiah, before the creator of the universe came as Jesus of Nazareth, it told us he would be an individual that would be despised by his human compatriots. And he would suffer and he would experience, literally, he experienced loneliness to a degree that none of us have ever experienced. And none of us ever will. And, the encouragement I have of being a Christian, I mean, I've had to travel and minister around the world. And, people say, how can you walk into an auditorium and face an angry audience, an audience of atheists, for example? And it's like, I realize I'm not going into that auditorium alone. God is with me. And just reminding myself, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. I might feel alone, but I'm never alone. But there was a time when God the Son was alone.
Thank you, Hugh. I have a question from Tony Sapafina from Georgia. Regarding the command to forgive those who have hurt or wronged us, does forgiving also demand that we reconnect relationships with them, or can we maintain a distance?
Well, when it says that we're to forgive one another the sins that they've committed against us, it means that when you really forgive them, you treat them like they hadn't sinned against you at all. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that you treat them in a way you weren't treating them the way before. Like if you didn't have much contact with them before, it's not saying you need to reach out and develop. You're free to do that. Basically, it's treating them as if the sin hadn't happened at all. And so it's going to be different for every individual. And you say, I'm not sure I really can feel that way. And, forgiveness for many of us is a process where you basically say, God, I know you want me to forgive the person for what they've done to me. And you take that action to seek their forgiveness and realize, God, I still got feelings of resentment. You need to help me release those feelings, because that's part of true forgiveness. If you're going to treat them the way that you treated them before they sinned against you, that means letting go of that resentment. But for many, letting go of that resentment is not an easy process. And realize, okay, God, you got to help me. I'm really too weak to do this on my own. Please help me and give God time to do it. The best material I've seen on forgiveness outside of what's in the Bible, in my opinion, are the books and the messages put out by Corrie ten Boom. If you've never read The Hiding Place, Corrie ten Boom and her sister took in Jews when they were living in Amsterdam in the Netherlands during World War II, and their story about how they forgave those that persecuted them. Because they were arrested. Corrie's sister died in a concentration camp. Her father died in a concentration camp. She herself was brutalized. But she tells a story of how she was able to forgive these German officers that were in charge of torturing people in these camps, and how she was able to win them over through her act of forgiving. And realizing, okay, these people, they had issues in their life, and they weren't going to be healed unless someone was prepared to forgive. And that was kind of the heart of Corrie ten Boom. I had a chance to hear her speak many decades ago, and it's like this woman, she had such a heart and a message of trying to help people to forgive where it seems impossible to forgive. That was her ministry. So, and incidentally, there's some wonderful short video clips of a Corrie ten Boom on YouTube. And, you know, those of us who can remember back in the 70s when she was on the speaking tour, I think we need to encourage the younger generations. This is someone you need to pay attention to. It's a message we especially need in the 21st century.
Thank you, Hugh. Susan Lambeau has a question. She says, I heard one well-known astrophysicist say that the scientists are starting to get away from the concept that space-time is an actual physical thing, but added that it was still useful to think of it as a fabric-like substance. Have you come across this idea?
Yes, and it certainly is analogous to a fabric. I mean, you'll see articles on the web talking about the space-time fabric of the universe, and you can kind of think of it like a sheet, but it can be distorted. So just like if you were to put a heavy steel ball on a bed sheet, it will cause that part where the ball falls in the bed sheet to be distorted. That actually happens in the universe. Massive bodies will distort the shape of the space-time fabric around them. That comes out of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that the gravity exerted by massive dense bodies will actually bend the space-time fabric around them. We've got proof of that through gravitational lensing. You can go on the NASA website and you can look at the photos they got there, the images they have, where we use our telescopes and we look at a distant cluster of galaxies, and there's so much mass there, the mass in that cluster of galaxies will actually bend the light of a quasar sitting behind that cluster of galaxies, bend it around that cluster of galaxies and towards our telescope. And the bending is such that we can see objects that we would never see if it wasn't for the gravitational lens. So actually, it's like a telescope billions of light years away that we can take advantage of to line up with our telescope and actually look deeper into space than would otherwise be possible. And as far as thinking of space and time as a thing, you know, when we look at unified field theories, how the universe begins with a single force of physics, and as the universe expands and cools down, as it cools down, that single force will split into two forces, then three forces, and into the four forces of physics that we see today. And if you want an analogy, you can take a bar magnet, and if you heat it up, the magnetism will disappear. You cool it down, the magnetism will return. And what's happening is the heat energy and the magnetic energy are blending together to make heat energy. And physicists believe that that's true of the universe, that if you go back in time, the universe will be hotter. And as you go back in time, it's hot enough that the electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force blend together to make a single electroweak force. And that goes all the way back to where you have all the forces of physics unified. But at each time, when you've got a force of physics separating out from the other forces, you get what's called symmetry breaking, where you get a dramatic effect happening in the universe. And most unified field theories posit that when you get the first symmetry breaking, this is when gravity separates out from the other three forces of physics. So you've got the strong electroweak force, and then you've got the force of gravity. And when that happens, you have a change in the space fabric of the universe. As the universe expands from the cosmic creation event, the universe has nine dimensions of space, and they all rapidly expand from the cosmic creation event. But when gravity separates out from the strong electroweak force, six of those nine space dimensions stop expanding. And since that time, they've not expanded at all. we still have these nine dimensions of space. Six are extremely tiny, three are large. Three are still expanding, six stopped expanding. The other thing we notice about space-time that tells us is a real thing and not just something imaginary is that the universe in Big Bang cosmology begins without matter and without energy, but it begins with space-time curvature because you got the universe squished into an infinitesimal volume. And as you squish it into an infinitesimal volume, the curvature of space increases. And so the principle here is that the release of space curvature, when the universe is about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old, produces photons. And so the release of space curvature produces energy. And then as the universe continues to release space curvature, you eventually get the appearance of matter. All that happens in the first billionth of a second of the existence of the universe, but it's irreversible. As Einstein's special relativity tells us, you can take matter and convert it into energy, and you can take energy and convert it into matter. You can take space-time curvature and convert that into energy and matter, but you cannot take energy and matter and convert it into space curvature. It is irreversible. So now, This is all stuff that's impossible to test by direct observations. I mean, there's no way we're ever going to build a particle accelerator where we can witness the separation of gravity from the strong electroweak force. However, what I just shared with you is a theoretically most consistent way of looking at how we begin with a space-time singularity and end up with the universe we have today. And on that basis, I'm with a majority of physicists here. Space-time is a real substance.
Thanks, Dr. Ross. Richard from Wheaton, Illinois. I was wondering about our galaxy and was wondering about the thickness of the disk. To me, gravity would eventually collapse the thickness into a thinner structure and that any pressure from gas or photons would not be sufficient to overcome gravity. Any insight on that would be appreciated. Thanks.
Well, I've written about that in this book where I've completed the first draft. There's a chapter there on the thin disk and the thick disk of our galaxy and the thin and thick disks of all spiral galaxies and how our Milky Way galaxy has a thin disk and a thick disk like no other spiral galaxy. Our galaxy is unique in dozens of different distinct ways, but that's one way. But the majority of galaxies we observe are not disk galaxies. They're spherical galaxies or ellipsoidal galaxies. And what happened there is that there's so many stars, so much mass within that galaxy that it basically collapses the structure of the galaxy. And it becomes kind of like a globular spherical or ellipsoidal structure where the stars are densely packed together. That's over 90% of the galaxies we observe are like that. And we also realize that a disk galaxy, a spiral galaxy, is perpetually in danger of collapsing into a spheroidal or an ellipsoidal galaxy. And the only way that spiral structure is sustained is by the spiral galaxy absorbing gas-rich dwarf galaxies. And now those gas-rich dwarf galaxies is consumed by the spiral galaxy, and that leads to more star formation and actually leads to the sustaining of the disk structure of the galaxy. And the amazing thing about our Milky Way galaxy, it's maintained a highly symmetrical disk with very little disturbances, very little feathers and spurs between the spiral arms. But that's because it's been consuming tiny dwarf galaxies at a very steady rate throughout the past 10 and a half billion years. And we see no other spiral galaxy that has that history. And you get a couple of spiral galaxies merging together, it's almost guaranteed they'll wind up as a spheroidal or an ellipsoidal galaxy. Today, about 6% of all the galaxies that we see in the nearby universe are spiral galaxies. When we look far away, like 10 billion light years away, we see that about 40% of the galaxies are spiral galaxies. And our galaxy formation basically favors the formation of a disk. The same thing with stars. You know, a star will form, and most of the material in the star will go into a star, but you also get this thin disk that becomes a planetary system. And keep in mind, even in our own spiral Milky Way galaxy, half the stars are in that central bulge. So it's kind of similar to what we see in our solar system. Most of the mass goes into the star. Most of the mass, ordinary matter, goes into that central bulge of our Milky Way galaxy. And then you get this disk. And there's actually two disks. I think I'm going to stop there because it gets kind of technical when I talk about the differences between the thin and thick disk.
Mark Durham from the Los Angeles area asks, Dr. Ross, you mentioned that 99% plus of the universe's entropy resides in black holes. Could you please elaborate?
Okay, I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, and it was Charles Lineweaver and a couple of other Australian astronomers have published this a little more than a year ago, where they basically looked at the entropy budget of the universe. And they were able to determine, it's like 99.99, there might be another 9% of the entropy of the universe resides in black holes that come in at greater than 1 million times the mass of our star, the sun. Those black holes exist in every large, giant, and medium-sized galaxy in the universe. In fact, one of the unusual features of our Milky Way galaxy is how tiny its supermassive black hole is. But that's 99.99%. And then almost all the rest of the entropy of the universe resides in stellar mass black holes that are coming in at, say, 4 to 50 times the mass of our star, the sun. You also get intermediate black holes, that's included. The intermediate black holes that come in at like thousands of times the mass of our star, the sun. But if you look at everything else, the smaller black holes and the supermassive black holes, they literally contain 99.999999, I forget how many 9% of the entropy of the universe. And the rest of it resides in stars and planets and the gas and dust in the universe. And if it wasn't that way, we wouldn't have the stars and planets that we need for life. So it's crucial that, but I was writing, I got an article that's going to be published in a religions journal. It's a journal that basically deals with theological issues, but they basically said, we want a special issue based on science religion issues. So all of us are writing articles for it are scientists, and I'm in the process of having mine peer reviewed by several astronomers. But the article I'm writing is about black holes and how they provide evidence for the Christian faith. But part of it is that black holes must exist in the universe for light to be possible, and they must possess the entropy that they have for light to be possible. And is how amazing it is that we live in the one place in the universe where we have to have all these black holes, but the black holes in our vicinity don't cause us any trouble. The black hole in our Milky Way galaxy is very tiny given the size of our galaxy. For example, our supermassive black hole is 35 times less massive than we see in spiral galaxies of the similar mass of our Milky Way galaxy. And the other extraordinary thing, as small as it is, it could still be really deadly for us human beings. But for the past 50,000 years, our supermassive black hole has been an exceptionally quiet phase of its history. And the black hole that's in the Andromeda galaxy, it's about 35 times bigger and would be a real problem, but it too, right now, is in an extremely quiet phase. And likewise, we got a really nasty black hole in the giant galaxy in the Virgo cluster, but fortunately, its deadly jet is pointed away from us rather than towards us. Anyway, I'm giving away the story, but what's in the article is just how everywhere we look, the black holes are exquisitely designed to make possible our existence and our civilization.
Thank you. Yuvan has a question. He says, the Quran claims Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, was visited by the angel Jibril, also known as Gabriel, when he was in a cave. The Quran also says his wife, Khadija, is the one who made the claim to Muhammad that Gabriel visited him while he was in the cave. I see a similar way of deceiving, like what happened in the Garden of Eden. Do you think Muhammad was actually hallucinating due to drugs, or was he actually visited by a fallen angel?
Well, what's interesting is that, as I compare Islam to Mormonism, they're eerily similar. I mean, both cases, you've got a Latter-day prophet who adds material to the Old and New Testament. And in both cases, you've got Muhammad and you got Joseph Smith claiming that they were visited by an angel, and how this angel gave them this revelation that led to the production of the three books of the Mormon faith and the Quran. And as I read what is written in these books, again, eerily similar. The doctrine of women that you see in Islam is very similar to the doctrine of women you see in Mormonism. The doctrine of heaven is eerily the same. And then if you actually looked at the Mormon scriptures and compare with the Quran, the language is very similar. And both of them seem to be going overboard to make it impress you with how spiritual the book is, how repetitious it is. A lot of repetition, a lot of fake spirituality, in my opinion. And that tells me that those books are from the same source. So I don't doubt the fact that Muhammad was visited by an angel. I don't doubt the fact that Joseph Smith was visited by an angel. But we're warned in 1 John that when we get these kinds of visitations, we're to put the spirits to the test. Because after all, Satan will appear to us as an angel of light. And whether it was Satan himself that appeared to Muhammad and to Joseph Smith, I don't know. It might have been some other fallen angel. But the fact that there's such a tremendous similarity between the messages tells me, and how different what you see in the Quran compared to the Bible. That's what's fascinating. You got both Mormonism and Islam claiming to adhere to the Old and New Testament, but the latter-day books that they add to the Old and New Testament contradict what's taught in the Old and New Testament. So that's why I'm persuaded that both Muhammad and Joseph Smith indeed were visited by an angel, but not by a righteous angel. And that both of them, I believe, were deceived. And I base that on the fact that the message that they give us contradicts what's in the Old and the New Testament. And incidentally, that's a technique I use when I'm sharing my faith with Muslims. I ask them, have you ever heard of Mormonism? Have you investigated it? And likewise, when I'm dealing with Mormons, I say, have you actually looked into the Quran? And what I've noticed is when they actually begin to compare Mormonism to Islam, they too get struck with the eerie similarities in both faiths. And it begins, I think, to open up to the fact, maybe I need to look at an alternative. And then they go back to the Old and New Testament. But I also notice this in both Mormonism and Islam. They claim to value and adhere to the Old and New Testament. However, they really discourage their followers from really diving in and reading the Old and New Testament. In fact, a Bible study I taught years ago was filled with ex-Mormons, and they said, every time we would dive into the Old and New Testament, the elder would come by and take it away from us and give us one of the Mormon books. And so the fact that you see that in both faiths tells me, again, this is not a righteous angel.
Thank you. We have a question from John Belling in London. Thank you for your fantastic webinar presentation. Found it useful in helping connect the law of decay in physics to the biblical reasoning for it. I have a Christian friend who asked me, what is the scientific basis for humans living 700 plus years, as it mentions in the early chapters of Genesis? I've read some of your books, and you mentioned potential more vegetarian diet and potential smaller amount of cosmic rays in your atmosphere and less radiation. And I was wondering how the law of decay would work with the cells of humans back then. Was there DNA just more able to withstand the oxidation degenerative process better?
Yeah, good question. I devote an entire chapter to the longer lifespans and the days before Noah in the book Navigating Genesis. And again, you can get a free chapter at reasons.org/Ross. And in that chapter, I do mention that, yes, you have to be in a vegetarian diet if you want to live that long. Otherwise, you're going to accumulate too many metals in your body, heavy metals, over the course of 500 to 900 years. And for that to be possible, you're also going to have to be living in a much lower radiation environment. And I mentioned in Navigating Genesis, the research of two astronomers, one in Britain, Wolfendale, and one in Russia, Oerlikon, and how they've been teaming literally for the past three decades on trying to understand the source of what they call a cosmic rainee. And basically what they're pointing out is that over 95% of the really deadly cosmic rays, the fast-moving heavy nuclei cosmic rays, those are the ones that are going to shorten our lifespan. He says they come from a single supernova eruption, a single supernova event that their measurements tell us happened less than 100,000 years ago and happened relatively close to Earth when it exploded. And so what that tells us is that before the supernova eruption, humanity would have been exposed to much less deadly radiation. You'd also have to be well protected from igneous rocks. Igneous rocks are loaded with uranium and thorium, and the decay of uranium and thorium will shorten your lifespan. What we notice is in the days before the flood, humanity was not global. Humanity was residing in sedimentary plains. And as long as they weren't exploiting igneous rocks for their buildings, they would have been well protected from the uranium and thorium in those igneous rocks. But once humanity became global and we began to build cities and transportation systems, now all of us are exposed to that uranium and that thorium. But I also make the point that you'd have to change the telomerase activity going on in the human body because we humans today experience our chromosomes getting shorter and shorter as we get older and older. And that shortening of our chromosomes means that none of us are going to make it past about 120 years, the limit that you see in Genesis 6, verse 3. The shortening of our chromosomes, no matter how healthy you live, you're not going to make it much past 120. However, in the days before the flood, I believe that the chromosome shortening wasn't as aggressive as it is today. I mean, if you don't have to deal with the radiation risks, there's really no need to have such aggressive telomerase activity. Today it's necessary because if it's not for your chromosomes getting shorter and shorter at a fairly rapid rate, you're going to die earlier as a result of cancers taking over your body. And so that's telomerase shortening actually is one of the tools that helps us live long enough that we don't get wiped out at an early age by cancer, as it is some of us do. But if you don't have the radiation exposure, you could actually have the telomerase activity working in such a way that it would be possible to live 800 or 900 years. What that tells me is God had to intervene in some significant way in the genome of humanity at the time of the flood. And what you also notice in Genesis chapter 11, when it records the patriarchs after the flood, you see that their lifespans are exponentially dropping. And that would be consistent with a radiation event, such as a supernova, and such as their exposure to uranium and thorium.
Hugh, it's about 12:04 our time. Did you want to continue with questions, or were you interested in going to the meeting?
We're at 12 noon now, so we're going to segue from the webinar. I know I didn't get to all the questions, but we do capture them. And when we start the class next week, we'll begin with those questions left over from this week. And okay, are you going to get to all the questions? Probably not, but we devote quite a bit of time for that as it is.
Okay, when you put up the URL, when you put up the URL, leave it up for a couple of minutes so that I can scrape off the questions because I have to copy and paste them.
I'll give you that time because, I'm going to share screen again so all of you will see the URL for the meeting. So this is the URL, and this is what you're going to need to get into the meeting. And, the big complaint I've heard about the webinar, there really isn't opportunity for us to have any meaningful fellowship with one another. Webinars really don't permit that, but the meetings do. But there's no way I can get all of you out of the webinar and into a meeting. And so the way we're going to do this is I'm going to shut down the webinar. And all of you are going to need to leave the webinar. So because some of your computers leave you in there, you want to exit the webinar, then come back in with this URL. And that'll put you into the meeting. And all of us will be able to see one another and talk to one another. And I'm also going to have the capability of putting you into small group discussions. And the discussion question that I'm going to leave with all of you for our small groups is to think about what we discussed today about how God has designed the laws of physics and the space-time dimensions to encourage us, to motivate us to avoid evil, to pursue virtue, and the process realize we need God's help to be able to do that. So that'll be the question, but it's also an opportunity for all of you to get to know one another. So definitely introduce yourselves to one another, your names, where you're from, your background, how you came upon to, this particular class. That'd be a good way to begin and jump into the study question. And like last week, I'll leave you in the study group probably for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll pull you back in. And I'll be doing that automatically. You'll actually get a message that says 1 minute, and then you'll all be brought in, then we can share together. So Mark, I'm going to exit this now. So quickly write this down if you don't have it. And what you're going to especially need are those last numbers there, 843-456-80354. So with that, let me stop share.
I got all the questions for next week, Hugh. Thank you for the time.
Okay, very good. So I'm going to shut down the webinar now, and I'll see you in the meeting.